unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. Our AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting tonight, we're having a speaker. Normally we do a open big book step study. Every week we read through some selected readings and we have a panel discussion, which is two speakers who go back and forth and have a little talk about each step. And every 13 weeks, we have a little get together where we get to have some food and some fellowship and a wonderful speaker. And we've been on Zoom up until this point, so we're breaking back into the world of real people and real life while still sharing time with our Zoom friends. So I would like to invite David to come up and introduce our speaker tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic named David.
Hey, David.
I'm grateful to be here, grateful to be sober tonight. Thank you all for just being here. Thank you for coming, bringing food, your good cheer. It's just wonderful, really, to be here with everybody. And I'm a little overwhelmed by it. And we got people on Zoom, like 20 of them. We're beating you. So Grant did a great job setting it up. And I was excited to introduce Chris tonight. You guys are in for a treat. I felt it appropriate for me to introduce her as I am the president, the Tidewater president of the Chris Wells fan club. Actually, I was recently removed from office for stealing the funds, but it's a controversial thing. No, I've been knowing Chris for many years, and when she was delegate and in the service context around the AA service structure, and I've just always felt a kindred spirit in Chris, and I have not heard her recovery story. And so I'm just looking forward to hearing you tonight. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, everybody. My name's Chris Wells, and I'm glad I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
Hey. I want to thank David for asking me and the group for agreeing to have me here tonight. I am, as always, nervous, and I'll get over that in a minute and start acting like the class clown. But but I very much I'm just overwhelmed by the number of people in the room tonight. This is the first in-person event that I've done like this since sometime in the middle of 2019, and I used to do this a lot, so so this is a big deal for me. My home group is the Women's Primary Purpose Group in Alexandria, Virginia, which would seem odd since I live in Carrollton, but I'm still Zooming with my Alexandria girls until I get settled in down here and find my home group. But at the moment, that's my home group. And I have a sponsor. I have a new sponsor because I lost my sponsor of 25 years in November. And my sobriety date is the 22nd of May, 1994. And if anybody had told me in 1994 that I'd still be standing here tonight, I would have laughed them right out of the room. Because this was the last place I wanted to be, right? I don't know about any of you, but I did not want to be here. I want to say hi to the people on Zoom. I didn't know we were Zooming tonight, but that's really cool. So I'm glad you're here. I can't see you, but I guess you could see me. But I guess what I'm supposed to do here tonight is tell you what it used to be like, and then what happened, and what I'm like now. And wow, that has changed a lot. I grew up in Hopewell, Virginia. I don't know, many of you probably know where Hopewell is. It's not that far. I don't tell everybody I'm from Hopewell, so if y'all could sort of keep that on the DL. I grew up in Hopewell. I was born there and raised in Hopewell, and I went to Hopewell Public Schools, and you know, it's just I was a Hopewell girl. Probably still am a little bit of a Hopewell girl. And the house that I grew up in, there was no alcohol in that house. My parents didn't drink, and I wasn't around anybody who was drinking really, and didn't know what drinking or drunk looked like. I didn't really, until I was a teenager, didn't have any exposure at all. Except that there I had an uncle that liked to drink beer, and he also liked to do woodworking, and sometimes he liked to mix them. And so he, you know, his hands looked like this, you know, he's missing a lot of digits. I remember, you know, how little kids, you hear stuff and you sort of put it together in your own mind. My parents talking on the phone, and mine, I guess, and well, Johnny Lee lost a couple more fingers, you know. Mom, somebody says, oh, daggone Budweiser, right? So then I see somebody drinking beer, and I think their fingers are going to come off, right? Because it's the kind of stuff, you know, little kids, you don't, you know, didn't have a sense for he cut his fingers off. So, you know, anyway, I didn't have a sense for what drinking or drunk was. And I got my aunt, Brenda, they were like nomads. They were all over the place. But in this particular summer, they were living in Georgia. I was 12 or 13 years old. I never have been able to pin it down, you know, entirely, and it doesn't really matter. But 12 or 13 years old, there were these two old drunks on the back of the farm where they lived. And they had, you know, their alcohol stashed around. And me and my little cousins, a couple of them, and my brother, we stole a bottle of liquor and went off in the woods, and we drank, you know, it was cheap vodka and iced tea. It was really horrible. but we drank a lot of it. And what I recall is that, I remember, I'm 12 or 13, everybody else is younger than me. Okay. And so what I recall is coming to, not knowing where I was, which was odd in these woods, because we played in these woods a lot, and not knowing really how I got there, and had to really sort of come to, and trying to walk out of the woods and get to a street and figure out where I was. And I stumbled across my little cousins passed out there on the ground. So I sort of pick him up, and I'm dragging him along. He's probably 9. You know, it's horrible. It gets worse. And so I get him out. I get him out of the woods, and you know, somebody came along and they saw us and went to get his mother, and she came and you know took him to the hospital, got his stomach pumped and all that stuff. And my uncle came home that night, and you know what I remember is my little cousin got in a lot of trouble. You know, he got in a lot of trouble. I didn't get in trouble because I didn't get in trouble. I was the oldest and the only girl, and you know, my uncle just thought I was the greatest thing, you know, since sliced bread. And you know, if he walked in the kitchen and caught me with my hand in the cookie jar, he'd probably say something like, "Which one of you boys stuck her hand in that jar?" Right? So I didn't get in trouble, but my little cousin got in a lot of trouble that night. And what I got was, my uncle said, you know, if I wanted to learn how to drink, I could have just asked him. And he sat me down, and we drank, you know, we drank that night too. He had me drinking Canadian Club, I think, I don't know, some other horrible stuff. And I found myself again, you know, passed out, throwing up, just had a horrible night. And what I recall is waking up and thinking, wow, that was fun. And I can't wait to do it again. I mean, I really believe I was an alcoholic, and all it took was a little bit of alcohol to activate it, right? And And so that's what happened to me. And I was not a daily drinker at that age. Obviously, I couldn't get my hands on it every day, right? But from that until I was in high school, when I had better access, I was what you might call an opportunistic drinker, right? And each time I had an opportunity to drink, I did. And however much there was, that's how much, right? And I was just one of those. I used to hear girls come to the rooms and they would say, all I ever wanted to do was drink like a lady. That never occurred to me. What on earth would anybody want to do that? Right? I wanted to drink like a pig. And that's exactly how I drank from the time I first got a sip of it until the day that I crawled in here. I drank like a pig. And if there was more alcohol to find or drink or whatever, and you know, I eventually, my mom and me, we started having all kind of issues, right? Because I'm a teenager and I'm becoming a drunk. And, you know, about 16, I bought a car. And so now I'm driving and I'm drinking. And, you know, my mom, she's like getting on my last nerve, trying to keep me from killing myself. And, you know, and I was just having fun. I'm just having fun with my friends, right? All I'm trying to do is have fun with my friends. And I keep forgetting about the Zoom people. Hi, Zoom people. I'm just having fun with my friends. And my, you know, my parents, but really both of my mom more, you know, she's like asking me irritating questions like, where are you going? Who's going with you? Who's going to be driving? Will you be drinking? Blah, blah, blah. When will you be home? And all this just stuff, just irritating, aggravating, trying to save my life stuff. And I just remember, you know, I just remember when I turned 18, right? I turned 18 halfway through my senior year. And I remember when I turned 18, I thought, well, now I'm grown. Right. But my mom had a different idea. My mom said, as long as you live under my roof, right? She still had those, all these people nodding, right? Yeah. All these people my age nodding, right? but that's what, you know, that's what she believed. And so she was still after me. And so eventually, you know, I'm just sick and tired of her telling me what to do. I can't stand it anymore. And I couldn't move out. I was working in the family business, right? So they controlled my paycheck. And so they were paying me less than minimum wage. And so I couldn't move out because I couldn't afford to move out. But they said they couldn't pay me more because I lived at home, right? You see? That's what they were doing, trying to keep me alive. It's aggravating. And so... eventually I'm sick and tired. I'm sick and tired of them telling me what to do. I'm not going to have anybody tell me what to do. I came up with a plan. So in 1982, I joined the Army, right? And now nobody's going to tell me what to do. Right? All right. All right, fine. I didn't think it all the way through exactly. I did okay in the Army, though. You know, I was a really good drinker, and the NCO club was where the promotion board really happened, right? I mean, there was this room where you went and you did all that, but that's not where it really happened. Where it really happened was at the NCO club. And so I hung out with the guys who had the influence, and I drank with them. And, you know, there were times when these, you know, sergeants major would, you know, they'd spot some new recruit and they'd get him over there and they'd bet him. Now, I weighed about 100 pounds at that time. There's a whole lot more girls standing here tonight. But I weighed about 100 pounds at the time, and they'd bet this big strapping dude that I could drink him under the table. And of course, he'd take the bet, and he'd throw the 100 bucks on the table. And then, you know, later in the night, this guy be fell over, and I'll just be, give me another Katila, right? And because I didn't know that meant I was an alcoholic. I thought I just drank good, right? But I did really well in the Army. I like, you know, I like the... the rules. I like knowing you, the Army was cool, right? Because you had the rules. The rules were the same for everybody. The house I grew up in, there were rules for me and rules for my brother, and they were totally different, right? And the older women are going, and they were totally different. And you know, they didn't even try to hide why it was. You said, well, how come he gets to? And they go, well, he's a boy, right? I mean, they didn't even try to hide it. So in the Army, the rules were the same for everybody. And you got to know up front what the rules were and what was the penalty for breaking the rules, which is really important for decision making, right? You need to know these things. You have to weigh your options. And so it was really great. I did well. I still like to fold my socks just so. I mean, some of that stuff stuck, but I did really well in the Army. And, you know, I went from E1 to E7 in 9 years. I mean, I was humming along. And then all of a sudden I got to this place where, you know, people weren't doing like I thought they ought to do. And I tried to re-enlist to get away from there, and he told me I didn't have any options. And so, you know, I said, well, all right then. I got out. You know, I went back home. I went back to, you know, Camp Couch, Fort Living Room, whatever. I decided I was going to go back home. And I hadn't realized this until recently. Now, I'm 27 years sober, right? And I was telling my story a couple of years ago when it occurred to me that I didn't really talk to my parents about going back to work in the family business. I just showed up on Monday like I worked there, right? I've been gone for 6 years and I just walk in on Monday like I worked there. And I was a trip. No. Seriously, I was a trip. And, but anyway, you know, I went back home and, you know, I thought this is going to be different this time. Nobody's going to try to tell me what to do because, you know, I'm older now. So, you know, right. Well, my problem was I took me home with me, right? If I left me wherever I was, I come home, I would have been fine, but I brought me home with me and I was the sick one. So that wasn't working very well. And next thing you know, me and mom are at each other's throats again. And things are not going well again. And I'm having all kinds of problems again. And then the next thing you know, I came to know about, now remember, I grew up the only girl, right? The only girl grandchild, the oldest. And, you know, I had this place in the family that was pretty awesome. And now I found out that my mom had a daughter before my parents were married and put her up for adoption. And so now I have this sister person who came back, and now she's older than me. And for some reason, everybody liked her, and I don't know. And I sort of lost my place in the family, you know, not the oldest and the only girl, but like most likely to get arrested, you know, because my sister was a mess, even bigger mess than me. And so I was no longer most likely to like knock the Christmas tree over and stuff. It was pretty amazing. And then I began to have memories. And I call them memories, not for lack of a better term. I just don't have a better term for it. If you think of one, to come up to me after the meeting and tell me what you think. But I began to have these memories that wouldn't leave me alone about sexual abuse between me and that uncle that taught me how to drink. And that had gone on for a long time, from about age of 9 to age 16. I was a hot mess. So I got this sister person. Now I got this uncle stuff that won't go away. And, you know, I'm just a hot mess. And I'm not saying that any of those things are the reason I drank. You heard me say before, right, that I drank alcohol and vomited and wanted more alcohol. So that didn't have anything to do. It didn't make me drink. But when I didn't like how I felt, I certainly drank more, right? And so these things really would get me cranked up. And so I was drinking more than ever. I was just a mess. I mean, just a mess. And I would manage to get to work, and I would manage to work most of the day, but I would have beer floating around in the floorboard of the car so I could go out at lunchtime and have a few beers and then go back in. And I mean, I was not doing well. And I was getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And I started to look for a counselor, right? Because I thought I needed somebody to help me. I needed some help with what to do. And I was really careful not to pick a drug and alcohol counselor, right? because I knew that alcohol wasn't the problem, but other people didn't seem to get that, right? So I had to be careful. And so I carefully chose this, you know, general counselor, and I went to see her. And, you know, the joke, 9 months later, I found out she was in AA. But yeah, I couldn't win. But, you know, what I recall about it is I went into the counselor's office, and you know how when you're seeing a new counselor for the first time, you gotta fill out these papers, right? So I went in and I got the clipboard and I got the papers and I sat down and I started answering the questions. And, you know, they're asking me about my family and they're asking me all this stuff. And I'm just happy to tell them how horrible my family is to me. And, you know, I'm thrilled to write all that stuff down. And then I got down to the question about, you know, do you drink? And I don't know why I knew that she couldn't help me if I didn't tell the truth, but I knew. And I don't know why I knew that, but I wrote it down. Yes, I drink. And it said how much, and I how often. And I said every day. And it said how much. And I put a case to a case and a half of beer every day, because that's how much beer I was drinking. That's a lot of beer. But that's what I was drinking. And I wrote it all down. And so I went back up and I took my paper back up to the receptionist window and, you know, waiting. I guess I had to sit back down and wait for them to grade it, right? Hoping for an A. Turns out I got two of them. Anyway, a little while later, the counselor calls me in and she has my paper. And I can see clearly she has my paper. It's my handwriting. And she starts going over the stuff, and we got down to the part about drinking, and she's a little shocked. She's, you know, obviously shocked. And so she told me later, much later, that the reason she was so shocked is because she normally takes, when she suspects somebody has a drinking problem, she normally takes whatever they write down and she multiplies it by 3. Right. So she was trying to figure out how I was drinking 4.5 cases of beer a day. You know, she was like, wow. But anyway, I remember she asked me, so do you think that you're depressed because you drink so much? And I said, no. I drink so much because I'm depressed. And it turns out that's the most alcoholic answer you can give to that question. And so that doesn't, on the spectrum, that's right up here. And so she pretty much diagnosed me there on the spot that day. Now, we danced around it for a long time, for months. I'd go in, tell her how horrible my family was to me and just how terrible my day at work was. And why does my dad have to talk to me that way? And, you know, just all these things. And I would leave her office and get a 12 pack on the way home, and I would get drunk. And then, you know, when she kept irritating me by asking about drinking every week, she wouldn't harp on it, but she'd ask about it. How much did you drink last week? And, you know, of course, now I've learned a lie, because if you tell the truth, they think it's a big deal. And, you know, so I don't know. But anyway, it took a long time. And finally, you know, the way she got me to come to you guys, this is you're going to love this. The way she got me to come see you is she said, well, you could just go and listen. You don't have to say anything. And I said, really? And she says, yeah, you don't have to say anything, you know. And she says, and you know, you might be able to help some of those people. So I came here in 1994 to help you. And boy, were you in deep if you needed my help in 1994. Woo! You had a problem if you needed my help in 1994. But anyway, I came to really to understand. I had known since I was a teenager that if I ever started drinking, I couldn't stop, right? I knew that. That was easy. That was easy peasy. If I took a drink, whatever time it was that day, I was going to drink till I went to bed now, right? It's not going to be, I'm going to drink for 2 hours and then go do something else. You know, it wasn't that, you know, if you ask me to help you move on Saturday, better get me before I have my first beer. Because once I drink the first one, I ain't coming, right? Even if I told you I am. And I knew that. I knew that since I was a kid. But what really got me was I had made up my mind I wasn't going to drink, right? This lady kept bugging me about drinking. So I said, all right, I'm going to show her that drinking ain't the problem. So I went home and I threw out everything that had alcohol in it. I mean, right on down to the cooking spray, right? All of it's got to go. Windshield washer fluid, you name it, got to go. Stuff I ain't never been inclined to drink. And I threw it all out and you know, it kept getting back in. Not the windshield washer fluid. I was good with it. It was the beer, right? It kept getting back in. And it would happen the same way every time. I would do okay. And then it would almost always be on a Sunday. But on that Sunday, whatever day it was, but usually a Sunday, I haven't slept in however many days I haven't drank. And I'm just miserable. And so I think I'm going to go and I'm going to get one beer, just one, right? Just one. And I'm going to drink that one. And then it'll take the edge off and I can get some sleep and I'll feel better. And so I go to the store and I'm going to buy the beer. You know which one, right? The biggest one, right? Whatever. If there was 40 ounce, if there was one that said 44 ounce, that's the one. I didn't care if it was red or blue, had a bull or a dog. I didn't care. Just whatever. Could taste like kerosene. I didn't care. Just wanted the biggest one. And I took it home and I would drink that. And then I would come to and there would be beer cans everywhere. And I would not know how that happened. Because, see, I think I forgot to say that by now I'd gotten this therapist to help me get some medication. Yeah. Drink on that stuff, guys. I was crazy. I was completely crazy. And so I realized that I wasn't going to be able to stop, I was screwed. It was the first time that I knew I didn't have control over if I drank the first one. I'd always known if I drank the first one, I didn't have any control over the second one. That was a given. But now I couldn't even not drink the first one. I had no control, completely none. I just kept trying. And it was every, 5 days, 6 days, 10 days. Never made it through that second weekend, but I just kept having these days and then I would drink and I have 4 days and I drink and I have 6 days and I drink. I haven't been to see you guys yet, but I just kept seeing this therapist and I just kept getting drunk and I was pretty miserable. And then really sort of a turning point for me on May the 2nd in 1994, I came to very early in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I couldn't get to sleep. And I thought, I'm going to have a beer if there's one here. And there was beer in the refrigerator, oddly enough. So I got a beer and I started drinking a beer and I came to with a shotgun in my mouth, trying to figure a way to pull the trigger. And the best I can figure is I was going to blow my brains out because I didn't want to go to work. Not because I didn't want to go to work ever, just I didn't want to go to work that day. Right? And somehow or another, this seemed like the solution. But it scared me enough that, you know, I made a phone call and, you know, my mom came and the therapist tried to get me in the hospital and, you know, my insurance said no. And, and you know, pretty soon it was, you know, my mom was staying in my house. My mom came to stay with me and she took everything out of there that wasn't a plastic knife, right? Everything in the house that you could possibly, I couldn't have stabbed myself with an ashtray. I mean, my mom cleaned the place up and then she was staying there. And now I'm going back and forth between suicidal and homicidal, right? And then finally I said, Mom, you got to go. I mean, you just have to go. You have to go. And so my mom left and then, you know, what I recall is there were 3 weeks there that are sort of lost. I don't know what happened in that three. And I think I drank some more in there and whatever, but on that day, on the day that I took my last drink, I got on my knees in the living room floor. I got up to my knees on the living room floor. So that's where I woke up. And I just said, God, if you're real and if you care, help me. And that nagging, you know, go to AA, go to AA, right? I'm like the chick with the helicopter and the boat and the right. And it's like, go to AA. So eventually that night I made a decision that I was going to go to an AA meeting. And I went to my first AA meeting. And I don't remember much about that meeting at all. But I remember that at the end I remember the one thing. One thing that stuck out to me in that meeting, the one thing. They were going around the room, everybody was introducing themselves in the meeting, you know, and I'm Bob and I'm an alcoholic and I'm Frank and I'm an alcoholic. And it got around to me and I didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not, but I was a people pleaser for sure. And so everybody else said they were an alcoholic. So I said, I'm Chris and I'm an alcoholic. And then I burst into tears because I knew it was the truth. And once I knew that truth, I couldn't unknow it, right? So that was really, that was a big deal for me. I picked up a white chip. That's what we used in that area. I was in the Petersburg area for white chip for surrender. And I picked up a white chip and I went to a meeting the next night and then I went to a meeting the next night and then here I am, right? Here I am. And somehow or another in the middle of all that 27 years passed by, I don't know how that happened. I didn't have any intention to be here this long for sure. I didn't get a sponsor right away because, you know, while some of you are pretty pathetic and you probably need that, I was relatively intelligent and I was going to take care of it myself. I can read these steps on the wall. I have the book now. I don't know what I thought. I was pretty arrogant for somebody as sick as I was, but I didn't get a sponsor right away, but I did get a phone number or two. And the one phone number that I got, this lady that I called every single day, but I didn't call her my sponsor. she was not my sponsor. And she was really fine with that. She didn't care as long as I called. And so I called her every day. And then there came a time, you know, the second step came really quick for me. And this is a sort of a long story. I sometimes don't even tell it, but I feel compelled. There was a family gathering that was happening, and it was not far from here, where they were pouring my uncle's ashes in the river, and so I had family coming in from Pennsylvania and all over, people I hadn't seen in decades, just, you know, lots and lots of family from all over the place was coming for this event. Now, I had not yet, I was probably 2 weeks sober, but I hadn't yet told my parents that I wasn't drinking because they were sick of hearing that, right? So we weren't going through that again. So I wasn't even sure I was good. I wasn't even sure I was done, right? You know what I mean? I might change my mind again because I still was stupid enough to think I was changing my mind, right? in any case, I'm headed down the road and the people that I'm going to see don't know that I have stopped. And right. And the people back there, you know, they don't know I'm going because I didn't tell that lady that I talked to every day who wasn't my sponsor. I didn't tell her that I was going to this thing because I was afraid she might tell me not to go. So anyway, I'm going down the road and my head started doing what my head does. And it said, the people back there won't know you drink and the people back there don't know you've quit and you could just, you know, whatever. And I'm like, no, I can't do that. You know, those AA people, they've been really nice to me and I can't go back and lie to them. And yeah, right. I couldn't anyway, I found out later. But my head, you know, my head has an answer for everything. And my head said, yeah, that's all right though. The people down there don't know you quit. And them AA people, they're really nice. And they'll welcome you back and give you another white chip like they did that other girl the other night, remember? Right? And so I'm going down the road and I begin to understand what they were talking about when they said nothing between me and the next drink, but a higher power, only I didn't have one yet, and that's a problem. And so I'm going down the road and I feel like I'm going to stop at that next store and I'm going to walk and I can't stop and call that lady. We didn't have phones in our pockets in those days, folks. I had a pager. You know what a pager is? Yeah. Some of you know, some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. So I couldn't just call. So I had to go to a pay phone. Yeah. You had phones. You actually had to like pay. And, so I was going to, but I'll never be able to call her because I'm going to walk right by that phone and I'm going to be in the store and I'm going to get a 12 pack and I'm going to drink it going down the road and I'm going to be half lit. And then I'll be almost out of beer before I get where I'm going, because if you get six down in a 12 pack, you're almost out. And and then I'd have to get another one. And then that night I would get really, really drunk and I would, you know, say God knows what to God knows who that I haven't seen in 20 years. And I'm going to really upset my mom and, you know, I'll pass out wherever I land and I'm going to wet my pants. I didn't need you guys to tell me any of this stuff was going to happen. This is what happened to me. This was my story. This is what always happened. And I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm not going to know what happened and people are going to be mad at me and I won't know why and they won't tell me. And then I'm going to drink all the way back. And you know, the thing that never occurred to me was that I might just like run off a cliff or up a tree. That never even occurred to me, right? That stuff never even occurred to me. I was just going to go back and get another white chip. And what I remembered was somebody said in a meeting that if that desire had come, that I just had to pray for that to be removed and that it would. And I'm driving down the road, gripping the steering wheel, thinking, that is the hokiest crock of crap I have ever heard in my life. But I didn't have another answer. It was the only answer I had. And so the prayer was pretty simple. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was pretty simple. It was something like, God, I can't do it anymore. Please help me. And it was gone. Just like that. Just like that. I didn't need to stop at the store. Just like that. And I remember that's what step two was for me, because right at that moment, I knew that I never had to drink again. I came to believe that there was a power greater than me and that he or she or whatever did care about me. And I never had to drink again. I just had to remember that prayer. And the real miracle is I've never needed it again to this day. So I went back and I asked that lady to be my sponsor. Seemed like a good thing to do at that point. You know, I just had this weird spiritual experience and I could recognize it for what it was. But I went and I asked that lady to be my sponsor. And of course she said, I thought you'd never ask. And she started taking me through the steps. And we went back to step one anyway, right? And we went back through step two anyway, even though I was pretty sure I had it. And over the years, these steps have morphed for me so many times, and they mean so much more today than they meant in those days. And it's way more complicated than it was simple. But I go back to these simple stories because that's the basics. And if I can remember that, the rest of this stuff, I can get the rest of the stuff. But I have to stay in the basic stuff. And so if you're new, all I can say to you, if you're new, just don't drink today. And don't be an idiot and ask somebody to help you. Even if you don't call them your sponsor, it still works, apparently. Step one, I want to talk a little bit about step one and how step one has morphed for me over the years, because I share this with people sometimes and they're like, wow, that's really helpful, thank you. So every chance I get, I share it. But I used to struggle with this relationship with my dad. Was probably the most volatile relationship in my life ever. And it could still be today if I wanted it to be. All I got to do is react to some of his garbage. But it was just horrible. And I mean, it was to the point of, you know, he'd say something and then I'd say something and it'd keep escalating and getting louder and louder till somebody threw something, the cops came. I mean, it was insane. And I walked around and I think I hate his guts, right? I mean, it's just horrible. And I was doing AA and I was doing Al-Anon. I like to say AA saved my life and Al-Anon saved my dad's life. But but I was doing both. And I still couldn't get it. You know, people would talk about, well, you're powerless over people, places, and things. What the hell does that even mean? Right. And then, you know, they would tell me, well, you know, just do a fourth step on it. You ever tried to do that? You're really angry at somebody, you try to sit in and do a fourth step on it, whatever it is. I mean, I don't know about you, but I sit down and do their inventory. Is that what you do? That's what I do. That doesn't work for me very well. So I would sit down, I would do my dad's inventory, and then they'd say, oh, well, you know, just if you spot it, you got it. So just cross his name off and put yours on and blah, 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 whatever. Not working. And then, you know, the one thing that did work for me, the one day I was in meditation. My dad is one of those guys where, you know, he'll start something with you and then you try to walk away and he like follows you, right? And he keeps on nipping at your heels. It's like having a little dog after your heels or something. He keeps it on. So we were having one of our things. We got through it and I called my sponsor and I said, you know, it happened again. And I went into the story and she said, It doesn't just happen. This is some way you're behaving. Well, wait a minute. That hadn't occurred to me before. So in meditation, I began to ask in meditation, what is the difference? I mean, I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, and I've never once took Miller Lite's inventory. Not once. Was I angry with beer? So what's the difference? What is the difference? And I began praying about it and I was meditating about it and then it came to me. I keep trying to think I'm powerless over him and it's not him. I can put a can of Miller Lite right here and it can't hurt me. I can hold it in my hand if I'm so inclined and it still can't hurt me. I can open it and hold it in my hand and it still can't hurt me. I take one sip, right? One sip. And something happens inside of me over which I have no control. And that's what's the same. When my dad says certain things or raises his voice to me, something happens inside of me over which I have no control. And when I began to inventory that internal reaction and spend time looking at that, I was able to find relief. So I offer that to you. It's not that, it's this. And it's not the outward reaction, because I cannot react all day. It's in here. I got to look at this. Why do I feel that? Why does my chest tighten up? Why does my throat get dry? Why does my fist ball up? It does, you know. So I offer that to you. My life, in short, my life got better when I did things that I didn't agree with, when I did things that I thought were stupid, like praying for God to remove that desire, right? When I did things that seemed dumb, when my sponsor said, why don't you pray about it? Okay. But, you know, it works. I remember early on calling my first sponsor, and I couldn't sleep. So I call her at like midnight, right? It's just to go to work. I call her at like midnight. She wakes up. She answers the phone. I said, hey, when do you start sleeping? She said, I was sleeping. What are you doing? I said, well, I'm sitting here in my chair with this big book and I'm reading. And she said, all right, listen, go to bed, cover up, turn the light off, close your eyes, and say a prayer. I said, okay. And I hung up the phone and thought, well, she don't want to talk. I already made up my mind it won't work, right? But I knew I couldn't show up at the meeting tomorrow and tell her it didn't work if I didn't do it, right? Because she's going to ask me. So I went to bed and I covered up and I turned the lights off and I closed my eyes and I said a prayer and I woke up the next morning. I was irritated that it worked. Because, you know, I've been passing out and coming to for so many years that I don't even know what it feels like to be tired anymore. I don't even know what it feels like. I don't know what hungry feels like. I don't know what tired feels like. So I just had to do stuff that sounded stupid. And my life got better. It's weird. So two more things. I used to hear a lot about justice and mercy and grace. And the one that stuck with me was that justice is when you get what you deserve, which is what I thought everybody else should get. Right? You ought to get what you deserve. And mercy is when you don't get what you deserve, which is what I thought I should get, right? Because I didn't mean to do that. I didn't mean to do this. But grace, I thought I was there for a long time in mercy, but grace I heard was when you get what you don't deserve. And I realize that today I live every day in grace. I do. I was so messed up. I was such a hot mess. And if I wasn't working in the family business, would have been completely unemployable. And somehow or another, I managed to pull a life out of this. I was 4 years sober. I got picked up my 4-year chip one night. I got married the next day. Still married to the same person. That's a personal record. I started college a few months later, and I quit smoking. And I still don't smoke, and I graduated college. And I went off and I got a job in Washington, D.C. And I just left there a year and a half ago, I guess. I moved down here to look after my parents. But, you know, I used to sit up there in D.C. in that office with my name on the door and think, wow, right? Drunk girls from Hopewell don't end up where I ended up, except that one did. What a gift. What a gift. So I always say that I'm Chris and I'm glad I'm an alcoholic, and there's inevitably some new person that goes, what? Or somebody comes up to me later and they ask me why. And everybody assumes it's because of AA and it's cheesy and here's all my friends and all that stuff. But I will tell you that for me, I started drinking when I was 12 or 13. I was so miserable. My life was already horrible. I don't even know if the stuff that was going on inside of me was real or imagined, and it didn't matter. I wanted to die by the time I was 7 years old. So alcohol, the very thing that nearly took me out of here, is what saved my life. Had I not become a drunk, I don't think I'd be here today. If I were just crazy, I probably would have killed myself, right? But thank God I was an alcoholic. Thank God there was you guys, and I had a chance, an opportunity at a different life, because I don't think I'd be here today. A lot of women came through AA and have helped me to get to where I am today, to be a sober woman, to be able to help other women get sober, to share my story in places like this and hopefully touch somebody's life, right? And I like to always say that a lot of women, and I do mean a lot of women, have spent time with me, have taken a moment, not just my sponsors, but a lot of women in AA have taken time with me, have spent time with me, so get with people, make friends. That's what this is all about. It's a fellowship, it's a program, but it's also a fellowship. And the two things are not the same thing. If you don't know the difference, ask your sponsor. But we're fellowshipping tonight, but we're also having a meeting. So it's sort of a program. But there is nothing in my life that is more important than staying sober and giving back what was so freely given to me. And like I said, I lost my sponsor last November. It was a tough time. We've been together for a long time. We've been through a lot of stuff. But, you know, I got a sponsor before she died. She went into hospice, and I got myself a sponsor before she died. Now I've not been one single day without somebody to hold me up, without somebody to be there, and for me to be there for them, right? Sponsorship's a two-way street. If you got a sponsor and it's not working for you, get another sponsor, because it's probably not working for her either, right? I mean, seriously, I'm not kidding. If you're dreading calling her, she probably don't want to hear from you either. Just saying. But anyway, what a great time. Thank you all. Thank you, Zoom people. Thank you for getting the Zoom people.
Wow. That was great, Chris. Thank you. Everybody have a chance to come up and thank Chris at the end of the meeting as well. At this point, we would typically pass a seven tradition basket. I don't know if we have a basket floating around somewhere we could pass. We got home group members who worked that out. Our seven tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Your safety is important. Calling the proper authorities does not go against any AA tradition and is recommended when someone may have broken the law or engaged in the safety of another person. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. Any AA related announcements? Okay. Guess not. Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. All our home group members, please raise your hands. And there's a bunch of them on Zoom too, so. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. In the back. All right, welcome. There's literature on this fine little table over here. Please see any of our home group members after the meeting if you need to buy a book or if you have any questions about the literature or if there's literature you're looking for and we don't have it over there. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at the podium here at the close of the meeting. Feel free to come talk to me or any of our home group members. And for Zoom, those folks that are new and looking for sponsorship, there'll be folks on there that can help you out as well. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, I really would like everyone to take a chance, opportunity to come up and thank Chris for her wonderful talk tonight. That was fantastic. It's probably one of the best talks I've heard in a long time. So please, please do. I'd also like to thank all the members of the home group and those folks who brought food and helped set up tonight. And also ask everyone, if you don't mind, giving us a hand, cleaning up after the meeting. We need to put away chairs and tables and clean up after ourselves so we can make the room just a little bit nicer than we found it. And feel free to stay around for a little bit and have some conversation and learn a little bit more about Alcoholics Anonymous too. Normally we have someone read the last couple of pages on 164, but I don't think I got that assignment handed out tonight. Does anybody have a book with them that would like to come read? Rachel, would you want to grab a book?
Put her on the spot.
Yeah, she looked like she was the most ready to go.
Yeah, yeah. Come on up.
I've learned not to give help anymore. I'm Rachel. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Rachel.
Our book is that one, yeah. Right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Our book is to be meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you have, of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
All right, I'm a little rusty, so I almost forgot about that until I read the last sentence. We'd like to close with the Lord's Prayer. You all stay seated, and we'll do the Lord's Prayer. After a moment of silence for those sick and suffering inside and outside the rooms of AA. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Thank you.